You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. Today we're going to start off with a recipe for Napa cabbage wedge with miso dressing. If you were to make a multi-part Venn diagram combining my favorite salad things, you could nestle this right in the center. It's one part wedge salad, the fork and steak knife kind, something that I am so into that I talked my podcast co-host Kenji into dedicating a whole episode to it. And it contains cabbage, and not just cabbage, but Napa cabbage, which I think deserves more credit as a salad green. Napa cabbage is a little leafy, a little crunchy, and yet kind of juicy too, and I've used it sliced thin in everything from this Italian-style salad to a classic Caesar. Speaking of Caesar salads, this salad answers questions that I don't think anyone asked, such as, what if we replaced the anchovies or Worcestershire sauce in Caesar salad with fish sauce? What if we replaced the Dijon with miso? What if we replaced the lemon juice with rice vinegar? What if we replaced the coddled egg with mayo? What if we got an umami boost, not from Parmesan cheese, but toasted sesame seeds and sesame oil? What if we topped it not with croutons, but crispy shallots? And what if we used Napa cabbage instead of romaine lettuce? Well, Deb, it would no longer be a Caesar salad, the pedants would correctly say, but these questions ran circles in my brain for the better part of a month before I caved, and this turned out to be a wildly delicious answer. A refreshingly crunchy, busy, dynamic salad that we can't get enough of. Ooh, I can't wait for you to try it too. Here's the recipe, Napa cabbage wedge with miso dressing. Serves four, takes 45 minutes, and the source is Smitten Kitchen. If you hate mayo, you can try plain yogurt instead. However, you might find that you like the dressing with neither. It just ends up thinner and more robust in flavor. You'll probably have more shallots than you need, but I cannot bring myself to make the effort to fry shallots and not have extras for next time. For the assembly, you'll need 1 to 1.5 pounds of Napa cabbage, often a half of a large one, 2 large shallots, neutral oil for frying, 6 to 8 radishes, diced small, 2 scallions, thinly sliced, toasted sesame seeds. For the dressing, 2 tablespoons of white miso, 1 medium garlic clove minced, 2 teaspoons of fish sauce, 2 tablespoons of rice wine vinegar plus extra to drizzle, and 3 tablespoons of toasted sesame oil, 2 tablespoons of a neutral oil, and 1 teaspoon of granulated sugar, 2 tablespoons of mayonnaise, salt, and freshly ground black pepper. To wash and crisp your cabbage, you're going to cut the cabbage lengthwise into quarters, leaving the end intact. Lower into a large bowl of cold water and let sit for 10 minutes, but longer's fine too. I've neglected mine for 1 to 2 hours before while preparing other things. Remove from the water, shaking off the excess and letting any sand or debris fall into the bottom of the bowl. Place on a thick kitchen towel and pat dry. To crisp the shallots, you're going to peel and thinly slice the shallots. A mandoline is ideal for this as it ensures the shallots cook evenly, but I sliced mine by hand. Place in a small to medium skillet and barely cover with oil. Turn heat to medium high and cook the shallots, watching carefully, until they're just lightly golden brown. And turn the heat off. Let the residual heat of the oil take them a shade darker to a medium copper brown. The color will change quickly at this point, and I've had to toss burnt shallots many, many times when I didn't watch closely. If you've sliced your shallots by hand, you'll find that some pieces are done sooner. You can use thin tongs or fork to fish them out sooner. Drain in a sieve, reserving the oil for the next time you want to fry shallots. And then spread crispy shallots on 2 layers of paper towel and season immediately with salt. Then transfer the shallots to a bowl. If you keep them on the towel too long, the oil on the towel will soften them, which will be sad. Next, you're going to make the dressing. In a medium bowl, whisk the miso, garlic, fish sauce, and 2 tablespoons of rice wine vinegar to combine and smooth out the miso. Whisk in sesame oil, a tablespoon at a time, and then neutral oil and sugar. Add mayo and whisk to smoothly combine. Add sriracha or chili oil. I use some from a jar of chili crisp to taste. Add salt if needed, but it's unlikely that you will. You could also add a bit more miso instead of salt. Then you're going to assemble the salad. Cut the cabbage quarters into smaller wedges and arrange on a serving plate. It's not mandatory, but I like to drizzle the cabbage wedges with 1 to 2 teaspoons of rice vinegar before adding the dressing for extra brightness. Drizzle the dressing over to taste and then scatter the wedges with radishes, scallions, toasted sesame seeds, and crispy shallots and eat right away. As far as doing ahead, extra washed cabbage, dressing, and shallots keep in the fridge for 4 to 5 days. You're going to store those separately. Next, we've got a recipe for sweet potato and marshmallow biscuits. Yum! Who invented this? I love it. I admitted somewhere in the comments last week that I'd all but abandoned making my own pumpkin puree these days, baking instead with the always reliable canned stuff. I think that as home cooks, it's our tendency to want to do everything and everything that we can be from scratch as such, but not that I'd been satisfied with the labor versus outcome balance of roasting pumpkin. To get a dreamy texture like one from canned pumpkin, I found I often had to roast, then puree, then sometimes cook briefly on the stove to thicken it up, and often I still found the flavor inconsistent, sometimes delicious, and often a little lackluster. I know, I just put you all to sleep. I promise there is an unapologetic goofiness ahead. What I didn't get into was my current obsession, and that's putting sweet potato where you would expect pumpkin. With the arrival of this guy, roasted sweet potatoes are in a near constant rotation, and so it was only a matter of time before they showed up everywhere. Whether I buy sweet potatoes from a Stop and Shop by my parents' house or the bottom of a dusty crate at a farmer's market on 2nd Avenue is a remarkably consistent creature of the underground. I roast them for 45 minutes, which makes my apartment smell like bubbling sweet potato caramel, i.e. heaven, and then I let them cool, and then I peel and run them through a potato ricer and have perfectly textured and flavored purees every single time. This year, I've been on a huge sweet potato baking kick, pies, pancakes, breads, and now this, biscuits. I have kicked around making pumpkin or sweet potato biscuits for years, but I never went for it because I imagined that they'd lack so many of the qualities that I like in biscuits. Firm tops, visible layers, an almost delicate crumb, that the squishy squash would make them overly cakey or soft. I have never been so happy to be wrong, wrong, wrong. What emerged from the oven last weekend was heady November perfection, separated layers. A plume of warm spices and an extremely moist biscuit that managed not to be heavy. Of course, I couldn't just stop there. That would just be too ordinary. So, nope, I dreamed instead of making a biscuit variation on the marshmallow top sweet potato casserole. Something I lie through my teeth about each year, pretending it's not my thing while reaching for another blistered scoop. One day I will learn that Thanksgiving is no time to feign highfalutin tastes and comfort food. Nevertheless, in my imagination, you'd break open a warm sweet potato biscuit on Thanksgiving morning and a sigh of gooey melted marshmallow would slink from the center, surprising and delighting like a Hostess cupcake. In practice, things didn't go as I'd hoped. Big marshmallows were too big, and 2 tiny ones buried in the center of a biscuit disappeared. I mean, seriously disappeared. Where did they go? I think that this guy knows. And she has a picture of her biscuit with like eyeballs on it, and just kind of like a little drool coming out of the sort of mouth slit, and that's where the marshmallows had melted. Greedy biscuit. Marshmallows inserted in the little slits on top, baked and fizzled kind of unattractively. So the most luck I had was rolling the biscuit dough half as thick and scattering miniature marshmallows over it, and then rolling the second half on top of it and cutting the biscuits from there. It's not ideal for re-rolling scraps, but the marshmallows held up moderately well. One day I'll get this right. Maybe a halved large marshmallow somehow adhered to the top of the biscuit. But Thanksgiving will not wait for that day to arrive. Nevertheless, whether you go highbrow, lowbrow, or completely off your rocker with these biscuits, they're just perfect, and they promise to behave if you let them sit at the table. Well, maybe. And then she has more photos of biscuits that have popped open and have marshmallow kind of again drooling out of them, and she's drawn little eyeballs on them. It's super cute. So New Yorkers, I'll be on WNYC today at 5:44 p.m., very soon, briefly discussing a Thanksgiving game plan for sides and sweets. I talk about starting early and getting done anything and everything you can before the big day, when the turkey and its trimmings will dominate your oven and ability to cook other things in the afternoon. High on my list of favorite to-do ahead foods are biscuits such as these. You can make them today and then cut and freeze them unbaked and pop them in the oven, still frozen, 15 minutes before everyone sits down, all the more gleeful at the prospect of freshly baked biscuits with or without a feisty toasted marshmallow middle. Here's the recipe: sweet potato and marshmallow biscuits. This makes 12 to 14 2-inch biscuits. 1 pound of sweet potatoes, red skinned are my favorite. 1/3 cup of buttermilk. 2 cups of all-purpose flour. 1 tablespoon of baking powder. 3 tablespoons of granulated sugar. 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon. 1/4 teaspoon of ground nutmeg. 1/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. 1/8 teaspoon of ground cloves. 1/2 teaspoon of table salt, and 5 tablespoons of unsalted butter, cold. 1 cup of miniature marshmallows, and these are optional. The day before, or a couple of hours in advance, preheat your oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Place the sweet potato on a tray and roast until soft, about 40 to 45 minutes. Let cool completely in the skin, the fridge can speed this up, and then peel. Either run the potato flesh through a potato ricer or mash it until very smooth. You are looking for 3/4 cups of sweet potato puree. I get closer to 1 1/3 cups from 1 pound. Melt some salted butter over any remainder and sprinkle with chives. Happy lunch. Yum. You'll probably have turned your oven off by now, so preheat it again to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And line a baking sheet with parchment paper and set aside. You're going to whisk 3/4 cup of the reserved sweet potato puree with buttermilk until it's smoothly combined, and then keep it nearby. In the bottom of a large whitish bowl, whisk flours, baking powder, sugar, spices, and salt together. If you have a pastry blender, add the butter. If you have a sturdy pastry blender, then no need to chop it first. And use the blender to cut the butter into the flour mixture until the biggest pieces are the size of small peas. If you don't have a pastry blender, you're going to cut the batter into small pieces with a knife and work the butter into the flour mixture with your fingertips until the mixture resembles a coarse meal. For both methods, you're going to continue by adding the sweet potato mixture and stir and break it up until the mixture is in big, soft chunks. Get your hands in the bowl and gently knead the dough into an even mass, using as few motions as possible, and thus warming the dough as little as possible. With marshmallows, you're going to roll or pat the dough out on a floured counter to a 1/2 inch thickness, and then divide evenly in half. Sprinkle the marshmallows loosely over half of the dough, And then place the second half on top of the marshmallow and use rolling pin to gently press the sides together, keeping the final dough thickness at a full inch. So without marshmallows, you're going to roll or pat dough out on a floured counter to a 1-inch thickness. For both methods, you're going to dip a 2-inch biscuit cutter in flour and then form biscuits by cutting straight down and not twisting. This will help give your biscuits the maximum rise. Bake biscuits on a prepared sheet for 13 to 15 minutes until puffed and slightly golden on top, and then cook on the rack and enjoy as soon as possible. Not cook on the rack, sorry, cool on the rack and enjoy as soon as possible after you have baked them for 13 to 15 minutes. As far as doing ahead, biscuits are best on the first day that they're baked. To make them ahead of time, you're going to arrange the cut biscuits on a tray to freeze them, and once frozen, transfer them to a freezer bag until needed. Bake at the same temperature, straight from the freezer. Biscuits will take about 2 minutes longer to bake since they're frozen. Next, we've got a really yummy sounding recipe for grilled nectarines with gorgonzola and hazelnuts. Sign me up. Listen, I don't make the rules. These things aren't rational, but at some point over our vacation in Scotland, a time when we mostly consumed fish and chips, more chips, steak pie, also with chips, a detail that I'm sure is unrelated, I began intensely craving the combination of peaches and blue cheese, even though I can't think of a time when they've crossed paths in my kitchen. Once we got home, I beelined for Salad Freak by Jess Damock. It's available on Amazon, Bookshop, and more indies. It's a cookbook that came out this spring because I had a hunch that she put the idea in my head, and sure enough, she had a combination of stone fruit and blue cheese waiting to fulfill my wayward vacation craving. If you're thinking you don't need a cookbook for salads, as I might have in the past, I'm here to tell you how wrong we are. We do, if not for exact measurements, then for inspiration. For more creative ways to throw together what's left in your fridge so that nothing goes to waste. And to figure out what to eat when you're in the third heat wave, fourth, fifth, heat waves are just a continuum now, aren't they? Of the summer, and everything that you thought you'd want to cook in August no longer makes sense because it's too hot to cook. Damock's book has us covered. There's a breakfast salad with yogurt, cucumbers, eggs, and toasted seeds. There are soba salads and shredded kale salads and tortellini salads and salad dressings with miso mayo and horseradish goat cheese and a barbecue chicken cob beloved by Snoop Dogg, and every single little thing is just a little bit unexpected and delivering the freshness that I need right now. So as for the nectarines, I'm trying to locate this salad on the meal continuum, but I want it everywhere. It's a dessert salad, or maybe part of a cheese course, or maybe a brunch salad, or maybe just something to have with a very cold glass of white wine in the late afternoon and pretend that we're on vacation in the Riviera. The grilled nectarines take on a pie-like fragrance even before you put anything on top, but the crumbled blue cheese, honey, mint leaves, toasted hazelnuts, and flaky sea salt coordinate blissfully into something so incredible together. I nearly ate the plate. I hope you put it immediately on your agenda. Here is the recipe for grilled nectarines with gorgonzola and hazelnuts. This serves 2 to 3, takes 15 minutes. Source, Salad Freak by Jess Damock. This recipe is a vibe, not a prescription. Feel free to use peaches or plums or another firm, ripe stone fruit here. I use Danish blue cheese instead of gorgonzola because it's what I had. Use feta, perhaps, if you don't like goat cheese. Or you could even grill some halloumi alongside the nectarines. You'll need olive oil and 4 ripe, but not too ripe, freestone nectarines or peaches, 3 tablespoons of honey, 1/2 cup of fresh mint leaves, 1/2 cup of hazelnuts toasted, 1/2 cup of crumbled gorgonzola or another blue cheese, and flaky salt. Prepare the fruit. You're going to heat a grill to medium-high heat, Cut the nectarines in half and remove the pits, and then drizzle with a little bit of oil and grill until charred and warmed through, about 3 minutes per side. I actually didn't flip mine, but it took more like 5 minutes to get them charred on my dinky grill. And then you're going to assemble and serve. Transfer the nectarines to a serving platter, drizzle with honey, and sprinkle with the crumbled gorgonzola and mint leaves, and then roughly chop the toastal hazelnuts and sprinkle them over the platter along with a bit of flaky salt. Eat with a fork and knife. You can serve it with very cold wine or a spritzy lemonade, maybe some prosciutto and melon if you want to tie it into a whole summer meal. I'd make these clams and serve with grilled bread, and there is a link at smittenkitchen.com. Our next recipe, we've got strawberry tart. A few times a year, I fall in love with tarts all over again, not only because Alex thinks that fluted removable bottom tart pan is the best name given to any kitchen tool ever, but because there are a few things not made tastier when rendered wide and shallow in a flour-like shell. In the winter, I gush over slices of warm quiche on a plate, billowing with lightly dressed greens, or a deep, rich, hard-to-forget ganache tartlet. But in the summer, it's fresh fruit or bust. This past weekend, not one but two tarts exited my kitchen in a new EnviroSax tote bag, both entirely inspired by the city of Paris. The first headed for my friend Molly's dinner party on Friday night to take on the classic tarte au citron, which is a lemon tart, so fabulous I might never make stovetop curd citrus curd again. I have mentioned before an ongoing fascination with whole citrus recipes. Those that know that the whole shebang from peel to pith to pulp, smartly leveraged in a dish, is infinitely more satisfying than those that go for the more low-hanging ingredient of juice. This entire tart is made with one single lemon, ground to a pulp with sugar, and then mixed with egg, melted butter, and cornstarch, and seared in a par-baked crust until the top is bubbly and the taste is absolutely worth bragging about. The simplicity of ingredients alone makes it worthwhile, but the grown-up flavor with the bitter, fragrant vibe straight from the lemon's edge makes it ready for its close-up. I can't wait to make it next with two key limes and half of a ruby red grapefruit or a whole orange. Here's the recipe. Fresh strawberry tart. One fully baked 9-inch tart shell made from sweet tart dough, and there's a link at smittenkitchen.com if you need the recipe for that. Pastry cream, the recipe's below. 3 to 4 cups of fresh strawberries, hulled. Shortly before you're ready to serve the tart, you're going to spread the pastry cream in the bottom of the baked tart shell and arrange the strawberries over the top. Le voilà! For the pastry cream, this is adapted from Paris Sweets' Dory Greenspan. You'll need 1 1/4 cup of whole milk, 1/2 of moist plump vanilla beans split and scraped, or 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 3 large egg yolks, 1/2 cup of sugar, 3 tablespoons of cornstarch, 3 tablespoons of unsalted butter at room temperature. First, you're going to bring the milk and the vanilla bean pulp and pod into a boil in a small saucepan over medium heat. Cover the pan and turn off the heat and set aside for 10 minutes. Or if you're using vanilla extract, just bring the mill to a boil and proceed with the recipe, adding the extract before you add the butter to the hot pastry cream. Next, you're going to, working in a heavy-bottomed medium saucepan, whisk the yolks, sugar, and cornstarch together until thick and pale. Whisking all the while, very slowly drizzle 1/4 of the hot milk onto the yolks. Then, still whisking, pour the rest of the liquid in a steady stream over the tempered yolks. Remove and discard the vanilla pod. Then you're going to put the pan over medium heat and, whisking vigorously and without stop, bring the mixture to a boil. Keep the mixture at the boil, whisking energetically for 1 to 2 minutes, and then remove the pan from the heat and scrape the pastry cream into a clean bowl. Allow the pastry cream to cool on the counter for about 3 minutes. Next, you're going to cut the batter into chunks and stir the chunks into the hot pastry cream. Continue to stir until the butter is melted and incorporated. At this point, the cream needs to be thoroughly chilled. You can either set the bowl into a larger bowl filled with ice cubes and cold water, and to ensure even cooling, stir the cream from time to time, or you can refrigerate the cream, in which case you should press a piece of plastic wrap against the surface to create an airtight seal. The cream can be kept tightly covered in the refrigerator for up to 3 days, or packed airtight and frozen for 1 month. Defrost overnight in the refrigerator and whip before using to return to its smooth consistency. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.